The federal agency tasked with protecting us from lead in our water is rushing through changes that may make things worse.
It doesn't necessarily make the public that much safer than what we have now.
I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, May 21st, how a new EPA rule may leave millions of people exposed to lead. Then, dating during the pandemic.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's like, what if Black Mirror were a rom-com?
And we're joined by the LA-based band Chicano Batman about how they're connecting with fans during the quarantine.
Touring bands are like truck drivers in the sense that you don't get paid until you go out and get the job done in different cities. You know, we drop off the music.
But first, how workers around the country are scaling back on hazard pay for essential low-wage workers. For more than 2 months, workers have been risking their own safety to keep the country running. From hospital workers to grocery store clerks to delivery drivers. And so to keep their workers from quitting, companies like Amazon, Walmart, Kroger, CVS, and Starbucks are providing their low-wage employees with small, hourly $2 to $3 raises or one-time bonuses. Some companies are calling these pay increases hero pay. It's also known as hazard pay. Now, as many states are reopening, potentially putting some essential workers at an even greater risk, a number of these companies, including Amazon and Kroger, have announced they will be ending hazard pay at the end of the month. Others, like Target, have said they'll also end the practice within the next few months. This is leaving workers in a precarious state. They will still be doing hazardous work. And that's where we start today on The Takeaway. Joining us now are Ben Steverman, a reporter for Bloomberg, and Molly Kinder, a David M. Rubenstein Fellow at the Brookings Institute. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Molly, before COVID-19, who was hazard pay typically reserved for?
So hazard pay has a history of being associated with dangerous duty. So military service people in the military service receive hazardous duty pay when they're overseas fighting in war. Some federal government employees are entitled to hazard pay when their jobs become dangerous, or in certain very high-risk industries like in mining, hazard pay has existed. This is a whole new ballgame because millions of workers in jobs that we didn't even think of as risky or hazardous at all have suddenly become so because of the pandemic.
Yeah. Do we know what percentage of employees, essential employees, are now getting hazard pay, Molly?
There isn't a great data on this. There was a survey done last month of a little over 250 organizations and companies. And in that survey, they found only about one in four companies was offering any type of hazard pay. And that's probably an overestimate for the full population, since there's a lot of workers not in that survey that work for local governments, for instance, or for nonprofit hospitals, where we're really not seeing a lot of hazard pay. So at best, it's about one in four. And the workers that have received hazard pay from employers tend to be in a small number of industries that are booming during the pandemic. So think of grocery chains, big box retailers, warehousing like Amazon, and pharmacies. Those typically are the workers that have seen some modest pay increases, but millions of others in hospitals, home health aides, mail carriers, delivery drivers, a lot of fast food workers, for instance, they haven't seen any pay increase at all.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Ben, how have the national brands that are giving their employees hazard pay been doing financially during the pandemic? Has hazard pay actually cost them a lot?
It's cost them some, and they've also spent a lot on cleaning workplaces, cleaning stores, putting up plexiglass barriers, all sorts of things like that that they say have eaten up profits. So Amazon said it was going to announce a big profit in the last quarter, but actually said all of that was eaten up by extra costs related to COVID. But at the end of the day, we're really only talking about a $2 an hour increase for a lot of these workers. So I'm not sure that the actual cost of the hazard pay itself is really making up that much of a share of that.
Ben, you mentioned Amazon. And during this economic crisis, we happened to find out that by 2026, Jeff Bezos, Amazon's CEO, will become the world's first trillionaire. That's trillion with a TR. Why are many companies announcing the end of hazard pay when there is still significant risk to their employees? Is it just purely about profit?
Well, I think profit is definitely part of it. They've made clear from the beginning that they wanted these to be temporary pay bumps. That's why a lot of companies didn't do a hazard pay that was an hourly rate. They just said, hey, well, here's a one-time bonus. And then as the pandemic went on and got even worse, they extend, you know, some of them re-upped that and said, okay, we're going to give you another bonus, but we don't mm-hmm. want you to have the expectation that we're going to continue to pay you at a higher rate, because I think a lot of companies are looking forward to the end of the year and they're seeing the highest jobless rate since the Great Depression. And this actually will be an opportunity for companies long term to actually either cut labor costs or stop an increase in labor costs that has been happening over the last few years with the strong economy and minimum wage laws have been increasing, and a lot of their labor costs have up until this point been going up quite a bit.
Huh. You know, in addition to that, Ben, companies like Kroger and Target, they from what I understand, they were going to cut hazard pay and then they announced changes and extensions that we're going to cut it, you know, later on. Were they getting pressure to continue hazard pay for longer than they had initially anticipated?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the pressure was coming from both their employees, who obviously didn't want to get paid less, but also customers who were, you know, so many Americans are stuck at home and they're going out. The only time they're going out is to the grocery store. And they want to make they want to feel like when they go into that store that the people working there are being taken care of. And so it's a public relations effort by these companies to make their customers feel better.
Molly, you've talked to many essential employees during this time. What are you hearing from them about hazard pay and whether it's helping them or not?
Yeah, so I've interviewed about two dozen essential workers over the last 2 months. So they range from grocery clerks who are receiving hazard pay to a lot of lower paid hospital and health workers, you know, and cooks in nursing homes, housekeepers in hospitals, home health aides who've seen no pay increases at all. And the headline is, I've yet to talk to an essential worker who does not want hazard pay. It's something I've heard across the board from everyone, that they feel that at this time, they're not only putting their lives at risk, but they're really worried about the family members they live in. So just going to their job has become a matter of life and death. And that's not what they feel they signed up for. And it's really important to point out that a lot of these workers, millions of these essential workers, do not earn a living wage. So it was there's already an argument that the grocery clerk at Kroger who makes $10 an hour, or the home health aides that are keeping the most vulnerable people in our society safe during this pandemic, they're making $9, $10, $11 an hour, and suddenly their lives are at risk. And so there was a very, very strong feeling that workers want to see hazard pay. Among some of the workers I interviewed in the grocery sector who are getting the small bonuses or the $2 an hour pay increase, they did appreciate that that was happening, but many felt even that was not enough. Because even when you start off at $10 or $11 an hour, an additional $2 an hour still doesn't get you to a living wage that can sustain a family. So there was a frustration even with the small token hazard pay that was offered. And now that it's being pulled away, the workers I've interviewed are terribly frustrated. They said, you called me a hero and suddenly we're disposable. The hazard hasn't ended. We're still having to wear masks. Grocery store workers are still dying. So why are these increases going away?
And Molly, also essential workers are striking about not getting hazard pay, right?
That's correct. I mean, it's been extraordinary the last 2 months, the number of wildcat strikes or, you know, petitions on change.org and unrest we're seeing with workers. And it's really a mix of a fear for their safety, so a call for better access to this life-saving PPE, but also protest around pay. So everyone from Instacart drivers, groups of them striking, or Amazon workers. We're seeing some wildcat strikes in New Orleans with sanitation workers who don't feel they're being kept safe, and they feel their low wages are even breaking the law now, but don't go nearly far enough given the hazard. And I think this level of unrest is a sign of how frustrated workers are at this moment.
Yeah. Ben, do you know of any executives that have taken pay cuts or are refusing bonuses in order to help extend hazard pay to their employees?
Yeah, a good number have taken small changes to their salaries. Actually, not so small. Say 3 months of salary they basically mm-hmm. foregone in one case. But the thing to remember about that is that CEO salaries are only about 10% of their total compensation when you add in bonuses and stock options and all sorts of things like that. So really, at the end of the day, these people, you know, the CEOs maybe are giving up maybe $300,000 or $400,000, but at the end of a few years, they're going to be making $11 million or $12 million wow. or $20 million. So this is a sort of a drop in the bucket and mostly a symbolic move.
Molly, I listening to that, I can't help but think about how this conversation over hazard pay really underlines like the larger inequities in our system of work in this country, right?
I mean, absolutely. I think this pandemic has not created inequality, but exposed it in such vivid terms. There are, you know, the folks who are most likely to be able to be safely working from home are those who already have the most. So many of the workers on the front line who are keeping the country going for the rest of us earn very low wages and have some of them have the least access to protective equipment is what I'm finding, limited access to paid sick leave. So if they get sick, they can't even afford necessarily to stay home. And it's real and also limited ability at work to have any voice to say, I'm afraid for my life and I want to see changes. So I think this is a moment where we really need to take a step back as a country and say, these workers are essential. They always have been. We need them now. And yet what they have in terms of safety, in terms of compensation, in terms of benefits, and even in terms of respect, which is a key theme that I'm hearing mm-hmm. from workers, is just really inadequate. And hazard pay is an example of this. What do companies owe their workers? What can the federal government do to step in to make sure that workers who are risking their lives for the rest of us earn a decent living?
Ben, are there any proposals kicking around Congress to help protect hazard pay for essential employees?
Yeah, so the House Democrats passed a bill just last week, I think, that included a $200 billion Heroes Fund that basically would subsidize hazard pay for essential workers through the end of the year. And it wouldn't be $2 an hour. It'd be actually like $13 an hour. Extra in pay for those frontline workers. The prospects of that in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, they're not great. There have mm-hmm. been some Republican proposals. Mitt Romney put forward one, but there seems to be a lot of new concern about the deficit on the Republican side and extra spending at this time.
Yeah, we'll see how things might change given the election and how long it might change for Congress to start to pass some proposals to protect workers. Ben Steverman is a reporter for Bloomberg, and Molly Kinder is a David M. Rubenstein Fellow at the Brookings Institute. Thank you both for joining me again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
And we've asked Amazon, Walmart, Kroger, CVS, Starbucks, and Target about their hazard pay policies. As we hear from them, we'll post their replies at thetakeaway.org. And have you been receiving hazard pay? Tell us if it has made a difference to you in this moment. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz. So you definitely do not know this about me, but before I became a reporter for WNYC, I spent some time as a dating columnist. At the beginning of my journalism career, long before I joined New York Public Radio, I wrote a dating column for the Courier-Post in New Jersey that was syndicated to a few dozen small papers around the country. The column was called The Bachelor Pad, and I was sometimes called South Jersey's very own Carrie Bradshaw. So in the years since I stopped writing self-deprecating stories about my dating experiences, single life has changed a lot. And so has my life. I traded in my bachelor pad for a wife and two kids. Now, the pandemic and the resulting isolation is changing how people date on an even deeper level. We're hearing from many of you about what dating has been like during COVID-19.
Hi, this is Barbara Novak from Little River, South Carolina. I am dating right now, meeting the dates in the park initially, and then once we get to where we're okay, we have dinners in or takeout. watch movies, listen to music, and just talk. It's been a challenge, but not too bad. Thanks so much.
This is Joanne from Denver. Yes, I am seeing someone, but haven't seen them since this all started. And we FaceTime every day and talk about when this will be okay and when we'll be able to see each other. And we still haven't come up with a date.
Hey, this is Caroline calling from South Carolina. So as far as the pandemic is going and dating, everything's been going good. I met a guy on Facebook dating right before everything was self-quarantined. We've been dating pretty normally, except for we can't go into places like restaurants.
This is Julie Motz, and I'm calling from Fairfax, California. I'm doing a lot of socially distant hiking dates. The only problem is that it makes for a longer time commitment to a first date than I normally like. And it's amazing how beautiful scenery can be spoiled by a boring conversation.
My name is Susie, and I'm calling from Manhattan. The pandemic has been a real challenge on my dating life. After not seeing each other for over a month, we decided that it would be okay for me to take Metro North up to see him. I leave my home with a mask, with hand sanitizer. So we're in a polyamorous relationship. And the other man that I'm dating lives in Brooklyn with his wife and his kid. We will not meet. There are too many people involved. I have so many friends in the polyamorous community, and it's been a real challenge.
Some of you told us you're feeling pretty pessimistic about dating in this moment.
This is Barbara from Brownsville, Oregon. Yeah, I've been in the process of, like, you know, looking for my soulmate, and this pandemic has pretty much eliminated any chance of finding one. My search for my soulmate has pretty much hit the skids for now.
And for others, it sounds like your relationships are moving a lot faster than they would have before the pandemic.
Hi, this is Craig from Pittsburgh. It's been really difficult trying to determine expectations and set boundaries when our budding relationship went from 0 to 60 in a few months. And we began spending most of our time together with few other places where we could hang out either together or separately.
This is Em calling from Nashville, Tennessee. I started reconnecting with a disjointed love right before the pandemic. We got accidentally pregnant, and he ended up moving in with me to help me navigate an abortion during the initial shutdown. Although we both considered keeping it, it was not the right time in my life for motherhood. Now we're living together 24/7 in a serious new relationship, getting to know each other and love each other. Being only with each other 90% of the time has been really intense and difficult, but also constructive. I feel like we've learned deep things about each other that would have stayed hidden much longer in normal life.
And this is something I've been thinking a lot about. When I wrote a dating column in the early 2000s, I was documenting how the internet and the brand new world of Match.com had revolutionized dating. Now, with the coronavirus, it seems like we're experiencing another major shift in how we date and fall in love. So I thought I'd bring in some experts to talk about what things are like today and what dating might look like in the future as a result of this pandemic. Jessica Goldstein is with us. She's a freelance writer who writes for Datelab at the Washington Post. And Marianne Fisher is a psychology professor at St. Mary's University. Thank you both for joining us.
Hi, thanks happy to be here.
So, Marianne, what are the major ways that this pandemic is changing how people date?
Everyone has to make a choice. And the very first choice they have to make is whether or not they're going to abide by whatever rules are in place and governing meeting up. So that's the very first thing to take into consideration. So if you're someone who's rule abiding and you're looking for somebody, if they say to you very early on in your online matchmaking, oh, let's meet, then that pretty much rules that person out. Or on the other hand, if you're someone that is going to be rule abiding, you're talking to other people who are rule abiding, that relationship is going to look very different during the pandemic than what we would normally see. So you're going to have a lot more discussion online, a lot more potentially meaningful conversations happening. And the data from different dating apps are supporting that.
Jessica, it seems like if people are getting to, are forced to start talking to each other online before they meet in person, that it kind of slows down the getting to know you process. Is that right?
I think in some ways it speeds it up because there's no distraction. There's no like banter about the bar that you're at. There's no skipping getting to know someone and just making out with them. All you have is text, phone, or video chat. And you really have to just engage with the person to whom you're speaking. And I think in some ways it will expedite the process of people not necessarily getting to know each other the way that they want to, but getting more vulnerable with the way that they speak to each other.
Wow, interesting. And what's happening, Jessica, with dating apps? Are people using the apps and then just communicating over them and therefore not meeting? Do we have any information from like OkCupid and Tinder about what sort of numbers they're seeing in terms of people using the sites?
That is a great question. I don't have data on that. All I have are anecdotes from friends and other dating app users. I think people are feeling the effects of social isolation and really do want to connect with other people. And one of the really good things about connecting with a brand new person is you have things to talk about beyond the immediate, so what did you do today? Did you change out of your nighttime pajamas into daytime pajamas? You know, there's this whole wealth of stuff to talk about with a stranger who's interested in you.
So it's actually easier and less awkward to communicate with strangers on these apps than maybe it was before?
I think it's awkward in a different way, but you do have the shared experience of the pandemic and how surreal that has made everyday life. And so you automatically have something really significant to bond with this brand new person over.
Marianne, companionship feels so precious right now. Are we seeing any change in what people are looking for from dating? I can't figure out whether people might be more eager for hookups just for like that carnal contact, or maybe they're looking for a longer term love because the future seems so bleak and too bleak to face alone. Is it shifting what people want?
I think it is. We're actually trying to get that data now. I know that a lot of the different online dating apps are reporting an increase in membership and also an increase in the number of messages people are sending. I'm more interested in the messaging, because if you're trying to seek someone out to establish a relationship, you talk to them, right? And Jessica was mentioning that, like, you have to engage in a different kind of conversation. And I think what might be ultimately happening, and this is speculation, but there are people that just want to hook up. You know, that hasn't changed. But I think there's a lot more people who are reflecting on the situation they're in. And some of the interview data I'm seeing really does show that. So, you know, they're going, hey, I'm taking stock for the first time, either in a long time or ever. And I'm realizing that if this sort of situation arises again, it would be really cool to have somebody here with me, right? And I think that's really impactful. And I think that's what's going to have a lasting effect for a lot of individuals, right? Like that need for companionship, to not be alone, to have someone to touch, you know, the most fundamental thing. Touch. So I'm really curious. So we're scrambling a little bit right now to try to collect some data before all the lockdowns ease up. And then we want to do a follow-up study a couple months from now, because we have data from before, right? So we can do a beautiful timeline to see how people's attitudes and expectations and behaviors have changed over time.
Jessica, I want to talk about the calculations that people are making in this moment. As states start to reopen, are people practicing safe dating right now? And in what ways are they doing that?
I think in some ways what we'll end up seeing is just an amplification of what was going on before, which is different individuals have a different threshold for risk and will be making their choices accordingly. So in the before, there were people who, depending on the circumstances, felt comfortable and safe going home with somebody that they just met at a bar. And then there are people who would not at all tolerate that level of risk, but would wait several dates, wait till they met someone's friends, wait till they could Google search somebody. So I think you'll see kind of a similar pattern where there will be people who are hungry enough for human contact and have done the calculus and decided it's worth it, it's worth that risk. And then there will be people who are much more cautious because the stakes feel pretty high.
Marianne, do you think those who are choosing to go out right now to date in this moment might feel a sense of shame that they're doing something wrong or dangerous, and should they?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I definitely think it adds a layer of like the shame and the guilt and the naughtiness and all those sorts of things. And in a way, that actually might be a binder, right? Like it might be a way of a couple coming together because they're engaging in this illicit behavior as a bond. One thing I think is really important to keep in mind is that people's ability to date right now is also going to be influenced by factors like, do they have a lot of pressures on their time? Like, are they taking care of their kids full time now? And are they engaged in a lot of meal prep? And what sort of activities are they doing? And that, I think, might also lead to feelings of shame and guilt, because if you're putting at risk other people in your household that are vulnerable, then that of course adds an extra factor to consider.
But Jessica, people are dating without seeing each other, and they're considering a dating right now, right? I mean, they're having like Zoom dates, FaceTime dates.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's like, what if Black Mirror were a rom-com? There's a lot of like, finding a workaround. In some ways, it's very inspiring because there's this sense that that desire to flirt, to fall in love, to have adventures, to feel connected to other people, it is, that feeling is not a casualty of COVID. People still crave it, and it needs an outlet, and we'll find one with whatever technology is available to us.
Do you think, Jessica, that some of the rituals of the dating world might change permanently, like moving in for the first kiss and other things that might seem right now like you can't possibly do that, and maybe things like alter forever because of the way that we're experiencing this whole pandemic?
It's so strange to even imagine permanently from here. But I do think that in the short term, permanent, like from now until there's a vaccine, any kind of physical contact will feel potentially more fraught, more dangerous, but also maybe then more exciting, more romantic, more meaningful. And I do think this has been like the factor that has normalized video chat for people for whom that was like an option that they were never really utilizing before.
Jessica, what about physical intimacy right now? The New York City Board of Health actually issued guidelines on how to protect yourself as best as possible from catching the coronavirus during sex. How are conversations around sex changing right now?
I wonder if in some ways, again, it's not like having sex with a new partner was some risk-free proposition before, right? You were always calculating how much you could trust this other person. How honest were they being with you? What disclosures did you need to make? What disclosures did they need to make? So if anything, it's like we're all undergoing this massive public health awareness program where we'll just have to be communicating more, and the stakes again feel a bit higher about if you can trust someone or not. But again, I just think that the need to do that and the desire to do that is so strong that any kind of like abstinence only guidelines will not take, as we have seen historically when for different reasons people found sex to be something that was too dangerous to engage in, people do it anyway.
Well, Marianne, one option, you know, sex is often thought of as something involving more than one person, but since that's not an option now, the other option is masturbation. And I'm wondering how this pandemic might change the way we think about sex and think about masturbation.
It's a very exciting question. I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where there's been different memes going around about, you know, the only safe sex, of course, is with yourself. And I expect that sex toy sales have increased dramatically. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting how that shifts like a society's view, right? And how we define sex as a result could also change. I don't know. It's going to be really exciting to find out.
Do you have any other ideas about how the long-term permanent changes in dating and falling in love, any other possibilities that you'll be tracking, Marianne?
Well, one side issue that I'm very intrigued by is creativity. And I think that this pandemic has offered us a really interesting opportunity to see how creative potential mates are. And creativity is a big area in my part of psychology. And we look at creativity as being linked to things like intelligence, mate value, so how well we think of someone as a potential short-term versus long-term mate. And then we judge men and women differently by how creative they are, all sorts of things. And I'm really intrigued by how our standards for creativity might shift over the long-term. Like if we're having to be really creative right now if we date, right? Like you have to think about things like, oh, let's share a recipe together and each of us make it and then we can eat it together all virtually, right? Or, you know, you could tour the Louvre or other museums online on your date. and learn about art together. It's like, I just think it's really cool. So I want to track some creativity in first dates as we get out of the pandemic. But in terms of the other long-term effects, in one respect, I think we're going to have higher demands for sharing and disclosing personal information, because I think people who are dating right now are getting used to that. And, you know, and that was something that Jessica brought up before, like there's not a lot of distracting information. So we have a situation where outside influences are sort of in the background now, where before they would have been more central. I think that's going to be interesting. Like, are people going to be expecting more companionship? Are they going to be expecting more personal disclosures up front?
Yeah, disclosures like, let me see your antibodies test results, that kind of disclosure.
It could be. It could be. Or it could be just like, tell me some of your vulnerabilities, right? It's going to be really interesting to see how it pans out for sure.
Jessica, before I let you go, do you have any advice for how people can date right now? I love the idea of taking a virtual tour of the Louvre together.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I will be stealing that.
welcome.
Honestly, my first piece of advice is sit near a natural light or get a lamp and put it behind your laptop, because normally you would go to a bar or restaurant with really good ambiance, and now your apartment is the bar. So do yourself favors and make sure that you're well lit.
Good Zoom lighting. Very good advice.
Yeah, good Zoom lighting. And you know, the other thing I would say is that there's no avoiding the fact that all of our lives have been totally upended. And so you don't have to pretend that that's not on your mind. And in some ways, hopefully that can bring you closer to this new person to whom you're speaking, because they're going through it too. We are all going through it. So as Marianne put it so well, people can be more upfront about their vulnerabilities. You can be more honest about the people you miss, the ways that you're struggling, how this has affected your job and your friendships and your mental health. And it can be something, even though, of course, it's something that is keeping you physically apart from this person, it could also be something that helps you really connect with them on a deeper level.
I feel connected with you guys just talking about this stuff. Marianne Fisher is a psychology professor at St. Mary's University, and Jessica Goldstein is a freelance writer. Thanks, guys. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Five years ago, the Flint water crisis brought lead contamination into the national spotlight. But Flint is not the only place suffering from toxic drinking water, and the federal agency charged with protecting us from this may not be doing so. The Environmental Protection Agency is rushing to finalize a major regulation that could leave millions of Americans exposed to potentially hazardous levels of lead. Miguel del Toro, a retired EPA scientist, says the new proposed rule does not follow scientific recommendations.
Industry won. I mean, it's pretty clear when you look at what we were trying to do, where we were trying to go, and where we ended up in this proposal. It's pretty clear who the winners are, and it's not the people.
Here to tell us more about this is Lauren Rosenthal, an investigative reporter with APM Reports. She's the author of the recent investigation, Buried Lead, How the EPA Has Left Americans Exposed to Lead in Drinking Water. Lauren says the current EPA lead rule has been in effect for about 30 years now.
It came about after Congress banned the use of lead in plumbing going forward. We had realized lead was not something we really wanted in our environment. It could cause all kinds of health problems, and particularly it was dangerous for kids. Instead of asking utilities to take out the lead service lines that they'd installed to connect individual homes to the water supply in cities all over the country, kind of struck this compromise. So if the utilities kept tabs on the water they were supplying to homes, made sure it wasn't corrosive, made sure it wouldn't eat away at the lead pipes, they would be able to delay removing the pipes, essentially. So the rule says that utilities have to test periodically, push through chemical treatments that can kind of form a protective coating, and hopefully, you know, provide safe and stable water.
I feel like there's a butt coming.
Yeah. And the but is, but these pipes are risky. Wherever they're located, there's always the chance that something could go wrong. If the treatment changes, if the water becomes corrosive, even if there's construction on the block where your home's located, there's the possibility that high concentrations of lead are going to bust loose and end up in your drinking water.
So in order to deal with that issue, the EPA was on track to update this regulation on lead.
Yeah, this was going to be the first big overhaul since the Flint crisis, and it's actually been in the works since before that. Our reporting shows that EPA started working on this in 2010 because it had become clear that there were some weaknesses in the testing. We talked to 17 employees, past and present, from EPA, and they told us that their research had shown that the testing that EPA had ordered utilities to do nationwide was systematically missing high levels of lead in these homes that are connected with lead service lines. This is about 9 million homes nationwide, mostly in the Midwest and the Northeast. EPA scientists recommended improvements to testing, tougher standards that would likely reveal higher levels of lead, would allow utilities to update their treatments, and would probably lead to pipes being replaced nationwide faster than they had been before.
And then what happened? So these rules were on the verge of going into effect?
EPA got recommendations from its scientists 8 years ago, but instead of moving ahead with them, there were concerns that they would be too costly. And EPA made the decision to hand off the question of these regulations to an advisory board. And our reporting showed there was heavy representation from people who work for water utilities.
Who was on the advisory panel that the EPA had commissioned to take a look at this?
So it was a mix of health activists, people who work for environmental groups, and then a lot of people who work for water utilities. And our reporting showed they had some help from an industry group to kind of get organized and put together an agenda. They suggested somewhat weaker testing, even than what we have now. And our reporting showed that ideally, they didn't want to have to test for lead in people's homes at all. In exchange, they offered to remove lead service lines nationwide, but there was a catch. They didn't want to have to pay for replacing the pipes on private property, so the piece of the line that connects into your home. And we know that that's a pretty dangerous proposition, because if you remove just part of the pipe and leave some of it in place, that can actually release more lead into the water. So not a great idea.
Who would be responsible for replacing that piece of lead pipe going into the home then? It would have to be removed, I guess. Would that then be on the property owner as opposed to the utility?
In most cities, yes. Most cities have set this up so that you are the owner of your home, your property, and this piece of pipe that connects into your home. But most people have no idea what their lead pipe is made of. Most cities don't have good records. These pipes in some cities were installed back in the 1800s. We just aren't sure where a lot of them are located.
What's the status of this proposed rule change now?
So right now, EPA is in the final stages of wrapping this up. They took the recommendations that they got from this advisory group, which had heavy representation from industry, like we talked about, and they directed their scientists to try to write a rule around that. The scientists we spoke with told us it was too big of an ask. There were real problems in the underlying research. There wasn't a clear justification for a lot of what utilities had asked for, and it just wasn't possible. So this effort that started during the Obama administration just kind of sat around. And when President Trump took office, EPA got the ball rolling again. And now they're pushing hard to get the rule finalized by the end of the year. So right now, EPA is sorting through 78,000 public comments. This is a really controversial and pretty important rule. And they're also waiting for feedback from their science advisory board. So this is a board of independent experts who are supposed to take a look at the research and tell us if this rule makes sense. So far, they found that it's really complicated. It doesn't necessarily make the public that much safer than what we have now. And they have questions about why EPA is recommending some of the changes that it put forward.
What's the status of lead testing now? During your investigation, what did you find out about how the EPA is testing lead now? And what do we actually know about how much lead is in our water?
In a lot of cities, we don't have a clear idea. I talked to a now retired EPA scientist named Miguel Del Toro, who is probably best known to people as like the whistleblower in Flint. He raised the alarm about that crisis within EPA. Del Toro did a study on the ground in Chicago almost a decade ago that showed that EPA standard testing was missing a lot of lead, that lead levels in some homes were four times higher than what EPA's regular method showed. And that's a lot. Del Toro told me that in a lot of homes that have these lead pipes, we're not certain how much lead could be coming out of the tap. And if we rely on EPA's method that they have now, that they've had in place for 30 years, we likely won't have a clear answer. EPA, in the new rule that it's put forward, says it wants to keep the same tests we have now. Every year or couple of years, the water utility will send bottles to homeowners' houses, and they ask that you collect the first liter of water out of the tap when you get up in the morning or when you come home from work at night, when the water has been sitting in your plumbing for a couple of hours. Because the idea is to catch the worst case scenario, the water that has been exposed to the most lead. And the problem is, we now know that's not what we're getting. The first liter of water out of the tap just captures what's in your internal home plumbing. And the lead service line, which is really risky, is sometimes yards away out in the street between your front lawn and the water main.
Where was that testing that you were just speaking of? Where was that conducted?
Sure. It was in Chicago.
Because you had mentioned Flint, and Flint, Michigan obviously had this major lead crisis in its water. And last year, Michigan started doing its own testing. What did those results show?
Yeah, Michigan added just one extra sample, the fifth liter out of the tap. And that's, you know, that's not exact. That's meant to get you somewhat closer to this lead pipe, basically. We analyzed all of Michigan's testing data from the last year when they added this extra sample, and we found that the average lead level reported to the state more than doubled. The single extra sample of water that Michigan utilities are now collecting has 2.5 times more lead in it than the sample that EPA asks for. And the number of water systems that are now over the lead limit set by EPA has also doubled.
And what do we know about whether poor minority communities are more likely to have lead in their water?
Low-income families and minority families are more likely to be living in older housing stock. And lead was used as a plumbing material a long time ago. That means that these families are more likely to be living in homes with lead service lines. And that means they're at greater risk of being exposed to lead in their drinking water.
Regarding this proposed rule change, is there any chance that this could be stopped or challenged before it's finalized?
So EPA is supposed to respond to the comments it's gotten from the public. And it's also supposed to hear back from its science advisors who are looking at the research behind the rule, trying to figure out if it makes sense before this proposal becomes final. There's always the possibility that activists could sue. But so far, we haven't heard that that's on the table just yet.
Lauren Rosenthal is an investigative reporter with APM Reports. Lauren, thank you very much for your work and your investigation.
Thanks, Matt.
Due to the pandemic, musicians around the country have had to figure out creative ways to perform while in quarantine, as venues have shuttered due to COVID-19. Some artists have had to cancel entire tours, like Chicano Batman. That's Color My Life, a song off Chicano Batman's latest album, Invisible People. The Los Angeles-based band released this album earlier this month during quarantine. It's the group's fourth studio album, and it's musically different from their previous work. So we connected with members of the group to hear how they're dealing with the release of the album amid the global pandemic. I spoke with Bardo Martinez, lead singer of the group.
Hey, Matt.
And Eduardo Arenas, the bass player.
What's happening?
So I've got to start the way I start all conversations these days. How are you both doing? How are you holding up given the quarantine?
Well, on top of quarantine itself, we both became dads. Well, Bardo is already a dad, but I became first-time dad. So that's taken a whole new different twist on this reality. And to tell you the truth, it's been a blessing to be indoors and watching the baby's growth every minute while simultaneously watching the growth of our album out in the public. Everyone's been really receptive. The reviews have been great. And the public and our fans have taken on a really good response to our change in sound and direction of the vision and the aesthetic of our sound.
That's great. Congratulations on the babies. That's wonderful. I think I heard one in the background there. How have you been hearing from fans? How have you been interacting with them? You said you've gotten a good response.
Yeah, we've, just basically Instagram, Twitter, and, I guess most of it is really positive. And we've been doing like Instagram lives as well. And, Carlos was teaching guitar and, we were all just kind of doing our thing on it. So we're trying to like adapt to the circumstances.
We did a Reddit chat. That was awesome. Like a Q&A. We basically started using a lot of tools that have been there for a very long time, but it takes a pandemic for us to evolve, digitally sometimes so that we can have access to our fan base and their opinions.
Have you learned anything about your fan base that you wouldn't have otherwise realized?
I think the most positive thing is that our fan base has been doing good with the change in our direction. We've put out a few singles and like Pink Elephant, and it was almost on purpose because it's such a different, like a hip hop J Dilla type of track. And a lot of the fans were talking smack, having no idea what the other 12 songs on the record were going to sound like, but we did. So we just kind of stayed confident and just kind of like tested the waters. I like when people, don't like what we're doing and they vocalize it, because those same people came back and said, you know what, my bad, this is amazing.
I'm curious about the economics of the fact that you've unfortunately had to cancel your tour and you're not performing at festivals like Coachella. Can you give us some insight on what kind of financial hit the band and other bands take because of something like this?
Well, touring bands are like truck drivers in the sense that you don't get paid until you go out and get the job done in different cities. We drop off the music. We're used to not getting paid for 4 months at a time, until we go and we go on tour. So it's not that we felt the hit so much now as we might feel it later on in the fall and early next year in case the second wave hits. I think too, it's unfortunate. I was just reading something this morning. I got like a Bandcamp email or Bands in Town email saying that if venues don't open for the rest of this year, like 90% of them, local venues will go out of business. It's a lot more serious than we think, but you know what, man, it's all we can do is stay positive. Honestly, I think if we look at the bright side of things, we will be on tour in no time and the audience would have had a relationship with our record. And there's no better sweet feeling than playing at a venue and people singing along to your songs, making you work less, and just enjoying the reflection and the energy that the crowds bring over to you. And then just serve it right back to them. So for us, we're just looking at everything on the bright side. It's better than having gone on the road, right after Coachella and releasing our album a few weeks later without everybody really getting to know the material. That's a definite plus side for us.
Like, I feel like this is really going to be like when the Berlin Wall fell, in the 80s. Like, it's going to be like everybody's just going to pour into the streets and into the venues once all is lifted. I mean, it's just going to be like 1969 all over again.
Much of your music has political themes, particularly in your last album, Freedom is Free, and some songs in this album can also be described as political, including invisible people. You sing the concept of race was implanted inside your brain. Can I ask who are the invisible people in the song? And are those the people who are, as you say, taking over?
Invisible people is everybody in society, the way I look at it. You know, it, to me, this whole thing was about really putting a question mark on the concept of race, because, you know, every racial categorization is a concept. It's a construct that has a long history. The idea that, you know, this person is, you know, white, you know, has a long history to it, because everyone really has a past, and every, you know, there is no such thing as this, that, or the other. Everybody has migration pattern where their family came from here and they came from, and, you know, and at the end of the day, everybody's actually more similar than they are different.
I see it pretty much directly in a different way. I mean, everybody has their own interpretation because there are so many layers. I see it as like, you know, if ICE wants to deport a lot of the undocumented in this country, then our produce is going to rot. Those are the invisible people that make the wheel turn.
Wanted to play a clip from one other song called Manuel's Story. One night I had to flee and leave my land. My older brother stole some heavy contraband. The gift for him, he wasn't there, they came for me. The drug cartel made me a refugee.
It's just a story my uncle told me. Like, literally, I was just hanging out. We were just hanging out in Panama. You know, he was just telling me stories about, you know, the drug trade in Panama. I mean, literally the song is exactly how he told it to me. You know, guns blazing and all, so.
Are there other ways in which your experiences as Latinos fuel your music? Is it part of everything that you do?
I mean, I look in the mirror and I see who I see, and there's nothing I could do about that, you know, so I embrace it. I grew up in the city of LA, you know, inner city. You know, the cities don't have, inner cities don't have resources for education. You know, we don't have resources for infrastructure. And I didn't have a choice about that. That's just the reflection of my reality. And that's the lens that I wear every day that I exist in this world. I didn't have a choice. That's how I came up to be. You know, and I think when we express, at least we express our art, that we have no choice. We don't know how to see the world any other way than the way we've lived it. And for us, we've overcame a lot of those obstacles, and it's enlightening to be in a position to be artists in this country as Latinos, and to be able to express messages of love and positivity and harmony, you know, and not necessarily be always about on the defense about being political, you know. And I think it's awesome to have a fan base that is also following that same vibration and opening their minds to shifts in sound and vision, the ones that we're providing. And I think that's an awesome thing that we get that platform now to, because you know what, we're not the only ones doing this. You know, we're not like, you know, the first Latino band to, you know, be making it. We come in waves. There's a ton behind us. There's been a ton ahead of us. And we're just part of this bigger narrative of Latinos, you know, and mainstream America. And I think we've always been strong. And I think now we just like, you know, making it easier on ourselves by, I don't know, having more success.
Yeah, for me, it's a big part of like, a big part of all this is to like complicate the idea of what quote unquote Latino is. Like I said, like I was telling you earlier, you know, when I hear the term, you know, whatever it may be, black, white, etc., they're just things in quotations, you know, because everybody has such a diverse past. Like literally, I did my DNA test, you know, my mom is from Cartagena, Colombia. My dad's Mexican, you know, so I grew up with a very like heterogeneous identity, you know, like it's not just one thing for me and it's not black and white for me. You know what I mean? And I kind of look at things from that perspective. You know, I did my DNA test. I'm like 20% African. I'm like 30% European, 40% indigenous, something like that, you know. And so it's like, there's a lot there, like literally, like I'm from everywhere, like genetically speaking, you know what I mean? And I think that's how I always felt, you know, interacting with from grade school till now, you know, I've never really fit in anywhere because of how I guess maybe different I see the world because of maybe because I, you know, have I've grown up with different, with all these different like ways of being, right? This kind of like I said, this kind of like mixed kind of thing. And I think all of us are mixed, and that most of us are, have this kind of very like mixed identity. But I think, you know, it's obviously, we all know that it's very easy to put things in boxes, you know, and to like categorize things and make it easy and palatable and sellable, et cetera, within the context of, you know, of our society, right? You know, we're here to sell things, you know? And so anyways, I guess for me, it's all about changing what it is that people are perceiving, like, and that's what I love about music. You know, I love the Doors, because Jim Morrison was just like, he was wild, you know. Jim Morrison was trying to just flip the script because he didn't feel right, you know what I mean, growing up in middle America, you know, with his father was a Marine or something like that, and he was rebelling, you know what I mean. For me, rebellion is very, very important. Like, that's how society moves and changes, and hopefully more moves towards something better.
Your sounds can't be fit into a box and have that same heterogeneous nature that you were just speaking of. It's very reflective of that same thing.
Yeah, or homogenous, right? We're not trying to be homogenous. We're trying to be the opposite. Or it's like, it comes from all over the place. And that's just kind of like the history of music, period. You know, some there might be a genre that might have a name like disco, but disco itself, like, whoa, it's like such a mix of like Latin percussion and like, you know, all the beautiful music that was made at the time.
Also, too, if we're like still continuing to try to fit within genres, we just make it easier for other groups to categorize us, you know, and doesn't do much to evolve, doesn't do much to move forward as an artist or as a people.
Yeah, totally. And like going off of that, like, they're just the new generation of musicians are just like, don't really operate within that dynamic anymore. Like there's just all like, there's just so many kids that are making amazing music, you know, that are in their early 20s. And it's just like, they take from hip hop, they take from rock, they take from, you know, all these different, you know, genres and elements. And, you know, when you go to a show, it's just like a wave of very culturally diverse people, you know, somewhere like, Madison, Wisconsin, you know, like that exists, you know. We may not see that on TV, we may not hear that on the media, but cultural diversity is everywhere, you know, and you see that like when you're actually on the street, when you're in the restaurant, when you're in a, you know, we're all over America. And that's, I mean, for me, that was a big eye opener, like just traveling throughout the country and touring and whatnot is like literally like what they show us on the media of like racial dynamics in this country is not necessarily true. Like, you know, there might be this struggle on the surface level where, you know, people like are triggered by certain things, but there's another level where people are communicating and living with each other every day.
Lead vocalist Bardo Martinez and bass player Eduardo Arenas from Chicano Batman, thank you so much for speaking with me and for sharing your music with us. Really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
If you want to hear more on our conversation with Chicano Batman, an extended interview will be posted on thetakeaway.org. Our board operators, Clara McKean-Kirsten and Debbie Daughtry, were in the studio at WNYC for us, alongside our director, Jay Cowett. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer. Alexandra Botti is our senior producer. Our producers are Jackie Martin, Ethan Oberman, Jose Oliveras, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Dina Sayed-Ahmed. Polly Iringo is our digital editor. Katarina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Hey everyone, this is Tanzina Vega from The Takeaway, and I'm back in the host chair on June 1st after being out on maternity leave. And let me tell you, I'm ready for conversation. We'll be holding leaders accountable and talking with communities you don't hear enough from as our world adjusts to a new normal. I'll see you on June 1st on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX.